In today's episode, I speak with Antoine Leboyer, who's the Managing Director of Venture Lab for Software and Artificial Intelligence at the Technical University Munich. TU Munich is a place where a lot of cool startups come from. I think they have built like a cool birth machine for cool technical startups. Lots of them are interesting in the context of this podcast, where I mostly interview SaaS founders, software people, people building like a technical thing. And yeah, I really like today speaking about Antoine's journey, starting at the Harvard Business School, being to IBM, many other companies, and nowadays supporting people building a startup. We talked about venture capital, finding a VC, what is important in the founding team, in general, tips for startups, and I would say let's jump right in. Welcome to a new episode of the Digital Economics Podcast. I'm so excited and really happy that you're here today, Antoine Leboyer, who is the Managing Director from Venture Labs at the Technical University in Munich. And you have like such an amazing long CV, starting with studying at Harvard and then many cool companies and such an interesting career. Happy to have you here today.
Happy to be here. I don't know if my CV is exciting, but the one thing which is true is that it is long because I must be 3 times your age.
Yeah, okay. Do you maybe want to guide us via your life a little bit? Because I think you know yourself the best, like what are the most important steps like in your career? Because I think if we jump into every company you worked for, then this podcast will be 4 hours. And I would love to do that, but I was told to not do podcasts which are 4 hours long. So can you maybe give us like a little journey via your life?
Look, so I'm in a generation where the recommendation of a university is that you go in large company, you learn as much as you can, and then you go to smaller companies. So I started into what was a very big American multinational company upon graduation. And at age 40 or so, I entered the world of startup. And I actually was in 3 startups which had various fates, which is sort of a very polite way of saying that they all failed, some form or another. And I decided that, I was probably, better on as someone who could be like a solo founder instead of joining a team. And I worked as a sort of entrepreneur in residence at a peer-oriented technology firm. And we did the acquisition of a software company called GSX, which was a company that was not moving, a little bit declining, but with very interesting technology that could be of use for further use cases. We did something which is known as entrepreneurship by acquisition. So we bought the company. And then what we did is that we professionalized it, we restructured it, but we also developed new products for new markets. And I ran the company for 13, 14 years, and then the company was acquired. And my investor and myself, we did pretty decent returns. And after this, and this is what I'm doing right now, I wanted to find a way of giving back. I felt that I'd been very lucky with education, universities, and I wanted to be in a situation where I could be helping other people.
I am happy and proud to announce the sponsor of today's episode. Working with startups and tech companies has taught me a big lesson. Finding the right tools for your team can really change your business. That's why I'm excited about Deel, the all-in-one platform for global teams. That's DEEL. Deel makes it simple for companies managing an international team to seamlessly hire, onboard, and pay both global employees and contractors. They handle all of the paperwork, exchange foreign salaries into local ones, and ensure compliance with local regulations. Deel is designed with the needs of a global workforce in mind. Seamless contract signing, easy expense uploads, in-platform time off management, and more. Plus, its customer support team is available 24/7, no matter what time zone. Ready to see how Deel can transform your global workforce operations? Head to deel.com to book a demo today. That's deel.com. Back to the episode.
I discussed with a number of universities to see where I could be of value, and I ended up in Munich at the TU, at the Technical University, where for the last 3 years I have been running the Venture Lab, which supports more than 100 startups in the area of software and artificial intelligence. And this is what I have been doing for the last 3 years and several months. And one thing to add, because you are from Berlin, I'm Swiss. And unlike many of my colleagues, I didn't study at TUM. And my Deutsch is schrecklich. And I am the only one guy who doesn't have a PhD.
but speaking about education, I think the first thing which I recognized on your CV was like, oh, this guy was at Harvard. How is Harvard different from, like, for example, Technical University? Or do you think this had like a big impact in your life studying? Like, I mean, Harvard like has this image of, okay, that's the best university, or definitely one of the best universities in the world. And I think Munich like also has this image. Like, do you think like it's really good for students to be like at the best of the best university?
I think it's good to be at a good university. I'm lucky that Harvard admitted me because I really enjoyed it. In my case, there were two things that I got by going at Harvard. When I stepped in 1990 in Boston, I had never been in the US. So I was able to acquire so much learning and understanding about the US, which is something which is really important. But that is in a way a minor element compared to the fact that the specificity of the way you are taught at the Harvard Business School is that you don't have lectures. You have case studies. And case studies look like this. You are being handled every day, three or two based on the number of cases, 10 to 20 page documents, which describe a real life business situation. And what you have to do is that you have in a very small amount of time to understand what this is happening, to understand the topic, to be able to identify the issues, and to try to make decisions and recommendations. And then you go the following day and you are in a class of 80 unbelievably smart and thought-provoking people. And you are one of the 80 guys which try to bring an idea, try to explain. And what you do by doing this is that you develop a huge amount of capabilities. The first one is that, unlike what you could think, it's a great way to acquire a lot of hard knowledge. It could be on finance, on marketing, on production, because you start by cases which could be pretty simple, where common sense helps you get a sense for what's happening. But then gradually and without realizing this, the complexity of what you do start increasing. And then even though you had no experience on accounting or on strategy or on quite a number of domains, you start realizing, hold on, I now can do this and I can do that. And this is something that is a way to get a lot of learning. The other thing is that you also learn that there is not one solution to one problem. So when we are in engineering, in mathematics, in physics, there's usually one answer to one question. But in real life, there are many, many possible answers. And by talking with your peers about this, it allows you to better understand the complexity and the richness of real life situations. And then the third thing, which is important, is that you learn how to express an idea in front of a group, how to be able to articulate it, how to make a compelling argument. And this is something that is something that has been unbelievably important. I'd like to add one fourth element, which is something that I realized later. But at the school, we have this thing where when you arrive, you have to do what is known as opening a case. And usually what happens is that the first person which the professor will ask to speak will explain for the next, say, 5 minutes without being interrupted what the case is about. And it's very common in real life that you want to express your opinion. Whereas what we do when we open cases is that we try to articulate what are the facts. And I really want to insist on this because this is something that always surprises me when people don't do that. And I hear and I see this all the time. You first try to get what are the real facts, what's happening. And then you make an opinion. And this is something that I have derived because of all these cases where you are being asked to present something and you don't want to rush and say, well, we think that they should buy this company or we think they should put the price at this level. No, you explain what this is about, you articulate the fact, and it is something that I have been applying in my real life, in my professional life, all through the years. Don't rush to have an opinion, just make sure that you get the fact. So a lot of learning, and it's very, very, very different from all the classic lectures that we were given at European universities where I studied before.
Mm-hmm. And how do you try, or is there a way how this is implemented now in technical university? So are there also like ways you take this kind of structure or are you in a different position nowadays, more in an advising role, not like setting up lectures?
So, look, the department that I run is called the Venture Lab, and specifically the Venture Lab for Software and AI. And it is a group which has been created with the purpose of helping startups in the key core technologies which will be creating startups. There are 12 to 13 Venture Lab in tons of domains like quantum computing, mobility, sustainability, built environment, chemistry, legal tech, additive manufacturing. So lots of various healthcare. And we are not necessarily academics. We come from domain knowledge. We have been active. My colleagues from in the aerospace used to have an aerospace startup in Singapore. And what we do is that we have to develop a number of activities and programs to help startup with the goal of doing 10 times in 10 years. In practice, what this means is that I have three type of activities. I would probably spend something like 3/4 of my time being close to startup, mentoring them. We have 120 startups which are registered at the university and for the Venture Lab. And these would be startups which have already incorporated. You could probably even double the number for those which are in the process of being incorporated, which are looked after by another set of resources. So I spend probably 75% of my time or 60% of my time following these guys, advising them, mentoring them on all possible topics. Another activity that we've done is that we have tried to develop a strong network of relevant parties around this startup. And this would be local VCs. And the profile of the VC that we need to work with would be early stage deep tech VCs, and particularly around software and AI. So I have developed quite a lot of relation with great VCs which are around Munich. Early stage investing is something which is extremely local. There may be a couple of exceptions, but usually first-time VC would want to have the ability to easily take the metro and after 30 minutes be at the door of the startup they invest. And we also have, thanks to all the alumni of the university, quite a lot of TUM alumni, which are now at principal or partner level at these VCs. And I've been very, very careful to make sure that we develop a relation with them.
How do you do that? How do you build that level of connection?
Because of my previous life running company, I knew a number of people and I said that I was going to go to Munich and they told me, oh, talk to these guys. And when I meet these guys and we explain what we do, of course, you know, we have a good story to tell and we can explain why we are going to be able to foster innovation on their domain. And this is a very natural relation. But something which I do systematically is that I also ask recommendation on who else I could talk to. And after a while, you know, suddenly you develop relations with quite a number of people, and this is how it came. I also want to insist, because good entrepreneurs have to learn to come and develop a network. And I came in 3 years ago having some personal social relation, a couple of friends in Munich, but I had not been working at university. I had not worked in Germany professionally. I had customers in Germany, but that's all. And entrepreneurs have got to learn how to build their networks very, very fast. You know, so that's what I do. I also have to be honest, the TU is an amazing university. So if you call people who are into this domain and you say that you're running the venture lab at the Munich Technical University, they don't listen to my name, they listen to my credentials. And this opens. The other thing that we've done in terms of building relations is that we have developed relation with local head of innovations for local companies. And I want to insist on this because startup, especially in software and AI, don't blossom and develop in a technical lab. It's very different if you are into chemistry or if you are in drug development, where a lot of the work is going to be done in the walls of the university. For software, you have value if a third party tells you you have value. So meeting relevant third parties is an essential part of what we do. If you're into the B2C, then you have to learn how to push an application and go to TikTok. But if you're in B2B, the fact of having developed connections with head of innovation of local companies is something which is very important. So we have a number of relations that we've developed over the times with people which are exactly of the same spirit. At the Venture Lab, we have one partner who's been sponsoring my department, which is this defense concern called IABG. And the head of the innovation, who's a fabulous guy, whose name is Daniel Cliche, he's someone where we have been able to bring him in many, many discussion with startup, because someone is coming, they are seeing this interesting, and then they can reach out to Daniel, I can reach out to other people and say, look, this is interesting. Can you find 45 minutes to discuss with this guy and tell us, you know, what comes out of that? And we've done this many, many times. And then the third element which I do is that I have developed specific content to be able to develop innovative and entrepreneurship. So we have a number of programs which we do in partnership with universities, student bodies, or a number of programs to be able to develop entrepreneurship. There's a set of lectures which I do around B2B sales and marketing, as well as talking to VCs. There's an organization called Toom.ai, which is a student-based organization where they have hackathon, and we develop these things. So in a sense, this is what I do. Helping and mentoring startup, developing a strong network of people which will help the startup, and developing and running several content. We actually call these micro classes as a whole, to be able to educate and to inspire and to bring students become entrepreneurs.
I think what's interesting about the technical university in Munich is that there are actually startups successful which come out of it. I think most like universities have these kind of accelerators, and yeah, then like there are some projects which are running for a year or two, but I think technical university brings out a lot of startups which are doing pretty well. I wonder, like, if we do it one step earlier, is everyone who's reaching out to you like able to get this kind of support? Because I guess that's a big part of the success story. Or is there a pitching process? What are you looking for in founders? So who's able to get this cool network, the support, the knowledge, etc.?
So that's a good question. I've stepped back with my colleagues in my venture lab, and we've tried to formalize this so that we could be a little more structured. But we usually look at four criteria. The first thing is that, and this is the most important one, if you are a bit, if your startup is a bit rigid, if you're, you know, if you are particularly what I call perfect German engineers, and you can't take, you can't take a question or a little comment or a criticism, or we can't make fun of you, that's usually a sign that you won't be a good entrepreneur. You could be a good researcher, make no mistake. And in it's important because in my experience, good VC always try to test if they can work with someone over the length of the investment. And it is very similar. We try to assess if the entrepreneurs can be coached. And it's very important. Another criteria which we apply is to get a sense for the core capabilities which we can see from the teams of founder. And if you're in software, we usually say that we need three talents: someone that can code, someone that can have a bit of a business sense, and someone that can structure markets. And usually this is the guy that could talk to a few people, extract element to write a story for the developers to develop. Sometime two of these talents will be present in one founder, but if you are a solo founder, it's unlikely you have the three. And if you come with a number of people, but one or two of these talents are really missing, then it's a sign that the team is not complete and we need to work into something. And then we look at two more criteria.
Before you jump into that, the three people you need. So for my understanding, if you're saying, okay, you need an engineer, CTO, that's clear. You need like a business person. Do you mean with that more like a product person who can sell and who is able to do some marketing and build a cool product? Or do you think more like as a CFO, like someone who's able to do bookkeeping, the financials, who has some understanding of how to get money in? Like the second person, explain it a little more.
So startup at the beginning should not worry about bookkeeping and legal stuff and everything else. It's something which is of course important at some stage, but not at its beginning. However, the two first talent that you've articulated are fundamental. So you need someone that can knock at doors, get prospects, raise funding, close a deal, but you also need, exactly as you have articulated, someone that can do the PM. And product management is an unbelievably part of the life of a startup, because if you come once again with what I call a bit of rigidity and you don't have this mindset of a product manager that really want to understand what is important, then you miss something. Today, I met a startup which is developing capabilities to help web applications develop product-guided tools. And we stayed around 30 minutes to really try to articulate the value that the guys were developing, why they were currently working with two or three prospects with great technology, until the guy could articulate something like, oh, hold on. Now I think that people are using our system because they have this request in terms of developer productivity. They have this problem around customer engagement and corresponding lifetime value. But the guy is saying, I'm not 100% sure whether this is exactly that, but I know that they've asked me this thing, these features, and this is going this direction. Well, this one, we don't want to do it because it may not be helping either of these things. These people who can do this sort of reasoning are unbelievably fundamental. So once again, someone that can code, someone that can do a bit of business, and someone that can become, that can do the product management. And these three things, we need to make sure that we can see traces of these in each of the guys that we, in each of the teams that we see.
So you need a developer, a sales guy, and a product manager. Well, and of course, like they...
I call this a nerd, a designer, and a hustler.
Okay. Sounds good. Cool. Okay, I understand. We can go further.
And then there would be two more dimensions, which would be the following. So we look at the technology looks cool. Mm-hmm. And don't ask me to develop and articulate what would be elements to make a technology would be looking cool. But you and I would agree on 99% of the cases.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
And the other thing is that in software, having a problem is more important than having cool technology or a solution. And the guys that really, really, really do well are guys which come in with, say, a cool, interesting technology, but an interesting problem to solve, good, strong domain knowledge. And this is where we have seen the importance of having this industry contact, because if you are coming out of the university, you don't have 5 years of experience in finance, you don't have 3 years of experience in consulting, you haven't worked in a hospital during 10 years, and you need to be able to quickly evaluate if the problem you've stumbled totally by chance or by design or whatever is a one-off or something which really is a generalist problem that many more people have. And this is something which is very important. And very often, because I am at TUM at a university with very strong students and amazing professors, the big challenge that we find is that the students don't necessarily have this domain knowledge, and we have to find ways of getting them to validate that there is indeed a problem and that the problem is worth looking at it. So this becomes very, very much a criteria. In fact, 6 months after I arrived, we try to do a sort of cataloging and classification of the startup we work with. And we found that 75% of the startup have interesting technology and lack the domain knowledge, whereas only 5% would have both.
And
it's not that it is, you know, a failure on the part of the student, the startup. Mm-hmm. It's normal. And we need to recognize that a lot of the work that needs to be done to develop them as entrepreneurs is not necessarily for them to improve the technology, which is usually pretty good. It's to get them to deepen the domain knowledge.
And how do you get into or how do you gain domain knowledge? Talking with people?
Well, yes, nothing beats talking to people. In fact, if you have a startup, learning to talk to people is something which you need to learn. So we see people who says, yes, I've spoken to people, I've showed them a demo of the product, and then they haven't said anything, so it's good.
My mom likes it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a book called The Mom Test, which is
highly recommended.
Highly recommended. No, we need people that can have the patience of listening, engaging, developing a relation. This is really important. So once again, if I mention this meeting which I've had this morning, this startup is working with three potential prospects, and they have, of course, element of the technology, and this is something which is being used, but also they are working with people which are totally okay to discuss with them and say, look, this is interesting, but if you could do this, this would really help me. And this is when you develop this relation that you develop something. And then after that, this is where you come to a situation where you develop the right thing, and then they say to you, please, can we keep this system? We are ready to pay for it. And this is usually what happens. In fact, I want to come back to something which is a definition of entrepreneurship, which was coined by someone named Bill Salmon, who was professor at the Harvard Business School and who was one of the founders of the Department of Entrepreneurship. There are many of them, and we can come back later, but entrepreneurship is doing something different, which is a value for certain people. And then you do a lot of testing and validation so as to prove that people would pay for what you're delivering. In other words, there's enough value for them to pay you, and that you can deliver what is the thing they pay for at a profit. And this is entrepreneurship. But at the core, you have to do and say, I can do something differently for people. And people will see the value of doing this. And then you have to do all these validation until you know that you really have value and that people would pay for it. And it's very important, because at the TU, we have a lot of people who are researchers. They do very strong technology. And I have often to explain to them that research, innovation, entrepreneurship are three different things. Research is advancing state of the art. innovation is very different. Innovation is seeing the value in what you do, okay? And usually the guy that recognize and articulate the value is not the guy who's done the research. And then entrepreneurship is making a business out of it. And I usually give two common examples. So you know the story of Steve Jobs visiting the Xerox PARC? Okay, so another book you need to read is the biography that Walter Isaacson did of Steve Jobs. It's an amazing book. I would like to encourage you and all the listeners to listen to it. At the time when Apple was doing the Apple II, which was a common line computer, Steve Jobs visited a research center, which was in Palo Alto, that the copying company Xerox had developed, and where they are taking the best and the brightest and says, can you please work on whatever you think is going to be the next big thing? And Steve Jobs visited the place and he saw the prototype of the first mouse, the first graphical user interface, and the first interconnected network workstations. So in other words, he wasn't the guy who found these things. He was the guy who recognized the value of these things. At the time, Xerox wanted to close this park, and because they said that they found nothing. You have the three biggest, most important elements which have been changing computing in the 70s and in the 80s. You have an unbelievably fabulous company, which was among the top 50 most recognized and successful in company, Xerox. And it's a third party who recognized the golden treasures which were into the Xerox lab. There's another example of innovation. Everyone knew about the relativity equations. This is actually fairly simple math to derive this. And until this time, this idea that according to the speed, the mass could be changing and so on, was something that physicists had found because of the math, and it was called a mathematical aberration. Until someone comes and say, no, it's not an aberration, there is a maximum limit of speed called the speed of the light. And Einstein was not the guy who found the equation. Einstein was the guy who was the innovator who saw the value of the equations. And this is the same thing. And innovators are people that are able to see how something can be done differently. Now, I want to come back to what I said about domain knowledge and technical ability. Most of the team that we work with are into this 75% category where they have strong technology but need to understand how to develop domain knowledge. But there are a couple of counterexamples. So we work at the Venture Lab with a company, a startup called CareMates. And the founder, Dylan, who is a fabulous guy, has developed a front end which uses AI to speed up the onboarding of patients at hospitals. He's a young guy. I don't know how old he is, but he looks like you, or he looks like my kids. And I was really impressed when he and I met for the first time, because when I asked him questions on how patients get on board at hospitals, he really knew his stuff. I really, really was impressed. And when I asked if he had been working at a hospital why he knew so much about this domain, he told me that both his parents were actually people working in hospitals, and that every evening he would hear about issues. And in a way, he absorbed a lot of the learning as well as a lot of things that would be the challenge faced by his parents. And so he goes to university, he gets exposed to the latest technology, and his mind of entrepreneurs and innovators is going to be, how can I actually use what I'm being taught to solve problems which are clearly articulated in my head? So it's a great example. His startup is called CareMate. He's doing really, really great because he has this mindset. And it's one of these rare cases, and I'm very happy, and he's a fabulous guy.
Okay.
I hope he's listening.
I will try to get him on the pod. So like having this example, so finding a good business idea, which I think a lot of people struggle with. I heard that a lot of times. I want to found a company, but I don't know what should I do. So finding a good business idea is just being excited about problems and focusing on, okay, is there a possible way to improve Or how do you think people should like look out for business ideas?
So usually you have to find something and try. You know, you can't do, I know that the university loves to do these ideation or to put people in a room with a ton of post-it notes and try to think. But I tend to believe that the best way is that you go out of the university and you try to see what happens in the real world. There are a few people who've tried, and then their startup do not manage to create enough value. And that's okay. You know, once again, you're talking to someone who has to close three startups. And what you do is that you need to develop expertise, develop experience, but keep this spirit and mindset of looking for something that can really be a problem. And some of the guys, which are, for instance, master students who work 1 or 2 years, come back at the Venture Lab because we can help them. We can give them the structure where they can expand. And also they come with a bit of experience and understanding. So we have a couple of cases like this which come in. If you have an idea, you try, and suddenly you find that there is something that people are ready to adopt the system and pay for it, then you have something. But otherwise, keep this mindset, go outside, keep this idea that you need to look for something, but apply this in your everyday life and suddenly something will come. Passion, I don't know what this is, because I think the whole world is marvelous and that a lot of things are interesting, but I think this is an overrated world.
It's an overrated world? How do you mean that?
Oh, I don't think that anyone is coming and saying, I'm passionate about database. I'm passionate about large language model. I think that people are going to say, look, I really think we can do something different on helping a frontline care worker go faster, and we can make a business out of it. It's thing like this, you know. And then when you do something, nothing beats the fact of making product that people use with satisfaction. In software, you want to do something which is called shipping your product. So if you talk to my former team at GSX, they will tell you that they always wanted to do more testing, and I always wanted to ship the product.
Okay, so you're saying like a problem can be to be waiting for too long instead of just giving it a try, going out with like maybe a half ready product or half ready idea, or maybe like even a 10% idea, but you already could talk to people about this idea.
Look, so I'm Swiss, so I can make fun of German people.
Go for it.
And I can also make fun of the Deutsche Bank, but that's another for another podcast. But software is something which is never finished. So there is not a notion of perfect software by definition. So the question is going fast, being able to test very fast that something is of value, and not trying to do like what you do, say, in aerospace. In aerospace, you don't launch a half-ready rocket or half-ready plane. Whereas in software, you have to learn to stop doing perfect engineering, but go very fast. The fact of going fast doesn't mean that you don't have something which is new and of value, but this is something which is much more attuned to the entrepreneurial spirit. And I usually joke when I see people and I say that they are perfect German engineer, because that's a tongue-in-cheek compliment. But it's important, because the first startup that I worked with when I arrived was into this spirit, and they had an amazing set of capabilities, but they were spending too much time perfecting the product, whereas in my mind and in the mind of several other people, the product was already extremely productized, very stable, had many of the features, and they should have gone to market much, much earlier. So this is something which I experienced with a very strong team when I've arrived, and then I realized that it was something that I was often faced, and I had to make sure that I could find this sort of search for perfection which you find in Germany.
So you think the perfection like probably is a blocker, especially for startups, because probably like for example in this case it would be like if they go earlier to market, not only that they could access like some money because they are earning some money and prove that there's a product market fit, but they also could like get for new features good input from customers. Okay, that's something we really want, or that's something we don't care about.
But you know how do you know that you got value if you got a software? It's not that your product works. All I have startup whose startup have failed, whose product were working very well, thank you very much. You only get value if someone else tells you you have value. And the way they tell you that you have value, it translates into euro and cents. So it's something that's that one has to come to terms with. If you develop, say, a new molecule for a medical disease, which is a small disease, not quite rarely encountered, if you pass all the stages of certification and testing, then you have a small success if this is a small disease, or you have a big success if this is a big disease. In software, you are okay, you have a good success if the people tell you this is a value and this is so much a value that I'm ready to pay for it. So you have to get out. I also would argue with you that you can't define what you need to develop, what features to add, if you don't have the ability to get prioritization from third parties. So you have to get out. In fact, what we do encourage the students which start their startup is to get out of the university.
I have one last really broad question. I think if you like would right now be in university or just leaving university, how would and you we've thought about an idea, you found like a perfect problem, you have your domain knowledge, you know, okay, it's better to start unperfect, but what are the main things you would do like as an early stage founder?
So one of the most important dynamic in startup and the success of startup is the quality of the teams. So I mentioned there's three type of talents that you need, but also you need to have people you can really rely on and people that you are very, very strong, you like to work with, whom you trust, who are complementing your capabilities. And you really want to get this thing. Startup are not easy. They are very hard. The a lot of things can happen. You can work like crazy, and suddenly you can fail because of something which was unexpected, and totally out of your control is happening, and it's something that is very important. So the quality of the team, the ability to be very resilient, is really something which is important. If you don't have this, stay into research, go and work at Siemens, and nothing gets Siemens, nothing to do about research. You need to be ready to fail one time, two times. The guy that is Dylan, whom I mentioned, he's had a couple of startups, so he has had experience. And he has developed this, thick skin type of capabilities that allows him to face problem with head-to-head when they arrive. And it's not something that everyone has. It's not something which is also for everyone. It has nothing to do with your IQ and your dedication, but it's something that good founders systematically have. So I think this is really, really something which is important. Some people develop a great life not by being into a startup, and that's okay with them. So this is really something that one has to keep in mind. And we don't mention enough of this in universities. You know, once again, especially in universities like the TU, the fact of being a good student or a good technologist doesn't mean that you are a good entrepreneur. It doesn't mean you could find the value, but it also doesn't mean that you're going to have some of the personal characteristic which we recognize with founders. I have one founder who's done his PhD at TUM, and they have had to do 100% pivot. In other words, they found something which came out of their research. They have around 100,000 euro annual recurring revenue, which is not bad. They get accepted to Y Combinator, which is this great accelerator in California, which used to be run by Sam Altman. They go to the US at Y Combinator, and then they realize that what they are doing is something that many others are doing, and they are a little late. And what they do is that in a week, they do a complete pivot, which means that they change the technology, the hypothesis, the domain. Sometimes when you pivot is that you keep a lot of things on the same place and you just modify one aspect of your startup. They did a 100% pivot. And in half a month, they reach 600,000 annual recurring revenue. And they're on their way to doing a double-digit raise with probably Silicon Valley most famous venture capitalist, because they suddenly have something which is so great. But the founder of this company, by the way, the company's name is Happy Robot. If anyone is listening, it's an unbelievable company. And the founder is a wonderful guy who also has amazing positive personality, is that they'd have no issues facing really what's happening, trying to be resilient, be persistent, challenge themselves. And this is these are entrepreneurial qualities. And when you meet a lot of startup, which is what I do with my colleagues, we can get this very, very fast. We realize when people have this attitude. And even though they may not have everything ready, remember the question you ask someone has got the perfect problem and so on. Well, there's no perfect problem, Louis, you know. But when we see people having these sort of entrepreneurial capabilities, something will happen and we are happy to spend time with these guys.
And would you, or do you think it's a good idea to raise money like early on, or do you think it's better to keep bootstrapped as long as possible?
That's a long story about VCs. First, I need to give a few elements. And I do teach a class on how you work with VCs. I've raised funding quite a number of times. The first thing is that you bring a VC when you know how to grow. If you bring a VC because you want to be developing products, you really need to have a very good technical story. If you need bring a VC, that's because you know how to grow and you want to go faster. We are in Germany. If you have capabilities which allow you to apply for this German exit funding, go for it. It takes a bit of time because, of course, they have to look at what you're presenting. But it's one of the great strengths which exists in Germany for founders. And at the TU, we have a lot of startups which are raising exit funding. And we are really, really, we can see the importance of doing this. It gives them, on a non-dilutive basis, the ability to get started during 1 year and basically come to a situation where they can really start raising either angel money and convertible or the first-time funding. It takes a lot of time to raise funding. It takes even more resilience than closing clients. And so go and raise funding when you need it and when you objectively meet the criteria to be able to get funding. Otherwise, find a way of staying bootstrapped. The other thing is that you need to understand that there are two types of VCs. Those which are happy to look at the product risk. So a lot of the early stage startup, VCs, that we work with are able to acknowledge the quality of a new design, new software. But then you talk to a number of other people once you are productized and your product is stable, and you need to spend as much on the development. And this is where you need to meet people which are growth VCs. And these guys will ask you not only necessarily the technology, they will ask you about how do you want to grow. They will use some specific acronym like CAC and LTVC, which is customer acquisition cost versus lifetime value of the customers. And you need to make sure that you talk to the right VCs which corresponds to where you are. And it's really important to understand this. So in itself, raising funding is not a goal. It's something that allows you to go much faster. And you need also to understand, what the value that good VCs bring, because it's really, really important. And I want to say something. There are good VCs in Germany. Okay, they are very good early stage guys we work with. Apologies if I can't name names, but give me a call. And we do have guys which are very good. The problems that we face is that markets that we have in Europe are fragmented and probably overregulated, which is why you need also to work with the VCs that can help you on the next phase and has contact to be able to do the next round. But we do have good VCs that we can work with.
Yeah, interesting to hear, because I hear a lot of people complaining, but I think especially for early stage, we have so cool founders who then like say, okay, I want to give back in a way, and I want support for the startup scene. Do you think also for later stage we have cool VCs, or do you think at some point you have to go to the US to raise money or even get like, I don't know, like I saw the WeWork series yesterday, like going to SoftBank, doing IPOs, etc. I mean, there's also that kind of stuff. But beside of like angel investors and early stage VC, do you also think later stage VC is existing in Germany?
So first thing, SoftBank is a unique, crazy case. Someone who invests into hugely established large companies already. So I don't know if we can put them into the VC situation. There's a great book that I'd like to recommend called The Power Law, which was written by Sébastien Malaby, and which is the history of venture capital. It's a fabulous, fabulous book. And the guy distinguishes the three type of models that you have with VCs. The first one being the VCs which were started at the Harvard Business School by General Doriot, and which was to try to identify extremely talented entrepreneurs in companies and make them owners. The second one was what the Sébastien Malaby called the Axel model, which is that you try to look for people who know certain domain in depth and can be on par with the people who are pitching them ideas. And quite a number of the VCs that I work with in Germany are like this. They are domain specialists. And then the third model would be the Y Combinator of A16Z, which are former entrepreneurs helping new entrepreneurs. And these are the three ones. And then you have the growth VCs, which would be, passive investors or people that they would reach out to, or SoftBank, which is in a class in itself. Most of the German startup would look in to go to the US anyway when they are expand. So usually, except with a few cases, you use the fact that you're in Germany for a certain number of domain where you can find people ready to work with you on the first products. And then you establish your product, you get started, and then you try to go abroad. And then the nationality of the VC can help you because they will help you getting being set up locally. So there are enough representatives in Europe of these big growth VCs which exist, which are going to help you. Axel is one, Sequoia is one, Index, Insight. These people do have European presence. The real challenge is that to go from Europe to the US requires a certain maturity, and it requires that you already passed a number of milestones. But you can't be successful, especially in software or in artificial intelligence, if you don't have your eyes set in the US. And I want to insist, the challenge that we face in Europe is that we are working in fragmented markets. It takes the same amount of time and effort to develop a product in the US, in California, or in Germany, in Israel, wherever. But then if you're in the US, you can probably amortize this development to customers which are 10 times the size of those which you can find in places in Germany or in France or in the UK. So this is why there is a specific issues. And the fact that you having a reference in California helps you in New York, whereas the fact of having a reference in Munich doesn't help you to go to Netherlands. But this is really the challenge that we have. This is really where right now I would love to see the EU spend time to understand how to help startup rather than come with tons of regulation, which would be important for large companies, which we do not necessarily facilitate and impact the life of early stage startup.
Yeah. It's crazy to see. I mean, sometimes I hear the background stories, which are not really public, that people are just leaving Europe because of some of these situations and going to US, which I find, it's a shame, like, because Europe is, I think, pretty cool and is already doing a lot of things correct. But for the startup world, I think there's definitely space for improvement.
Also the if you have a startup, you want your product to be used worldwide. At some stage, there's nothing wrong. If American startup or a startup from other countries are coming to Europe, why should a startup from Europe go to these places as well? There's nothing wrong with that.
I want to be respectful with your time, and I see we are already a little over time. But Antoine, thank you so much for sharing the insights you have from WTU Munich and the labs here. Thank you so much for showing me today a little bit about the VC world and the startup world.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I will list the books we talked about in the show notes, which was The Power of Law, Venture Capital, and The Making of the New Future from Sebastian Mallaby, the Steve Jobs biography, The Mom's Test. If you like the episode, please give it a like, give it a 5-star review, and if you subscribe, and follow. I'm happy, and I see you next time in the next episode. Thank you so much. Have a nice day. Bye-bye.